You are listening to Mike Seminary and Friends.
I think I've shared with you before that I'm blessed to be in this Bible study group. Started during COVID, really. And the group has expanded to where the founder of this Bible study almost 45 years ago tried to go back to in person, but the membership or the attendees of the Bible study were beyond the local geographic region where he started it. And so we still meet on Zoom. Well, not too long ago, one of the participants of the Bible study said, "Mike, I have a guest for you." And as I did a little research on my guest and the wonderful work, the organization that we'll talk about here momentarily, what they do, it just struck me. And I don't know if I get moved more by anything than people that are working with kids that have disadvantages that they don't control. It's just part of their life, part of the world, where they're orphaned, they're impoverished, they have disabilities, maybe they're abandoned. Maybe people don't even care for them. But because of the way God works, he puts people in place that start organizations that start serving them. And this one, I think they serve over 1,500 kids in a place in the world I've never been to, Bogota, Colombia. So it gives me great pleasure to say good morning to Clean Maury. It's great to meet you, actually. How are you? And welcome to Mike Seminary and Friends, Colleen.
Well, it's great to meet you too, Mike. And I'm doing great. I'm counting blessings and realizing there's no end to that counting. Yeah.
You know, thank you for your time, but more importantly, thank you for what you're doing for kids. And it doesn't matter where they are, but in a place where they've been abandoned, et cetera, and we'll get to that. But I want to learn a little bit more about you. We talked very briefly about how we were connected, and we'll talk about that too.
Right.
So, but here's my first question out of curiosity. Mm-hmm. You're an educator by trade and passion.
Right.
Where along the line of your journey, and go into as much detail as you like, did you have this heart put in place to reach out to kids, and then especially the Light and Life Foundation that we'll talk about soon as well?
Mm-hmm. Well, the passion to work and be involved with kids really goes way back to when I was in high school. I mean, even before that, from the age of 15 on, I've been involved with various different kinds of programs and whatnot that reach out to children. I taught private swimming lessons for 48 years. A lot of the children having special needs. And boy, that was a blessing just working with those kids. But it was clear to me that my career path needed to involve children. And I initially was thinking of physical therapy, but then I discovered doing motor skill development and physical activity for children with special needs. And so that would be under the umbrella of education rather than medicine. And I pursued that route. And it's, you know, the ways of life are so curious. I completed my third year at University of Vermont. And then the next year, one or the other of the semesters, we were, you know, supposed to be going out to student teach. And in those days, teaching jobs are hard to come by, and they didn't want to limit us to just Vermont. So they said, if we can get supervision anywhere else, you know, let's try to do that. So six of us ended up going out to San Diego, California. And we organized, the schools had organized supervision for children, super for us, and then we could then be working with the children. The interesting thing that happened is after driving the 3,000 miles across the country in my un-air conditioned Datsun B210, I arrived in Carlsbad, California, with two of the gals. The other three ended up going up to Santa Barbara. And we went to our respective schools. One gal was in high school working as, you know, doing her student teaching, one middle school, and I was elementary school. And I got there, and there was no master teacher who taught. There was no program. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, now what am I going to do? You know? So I approached the principal and said, I'm wondering if you would be in agreement to me designing a program for your school and you fill the role of supervising that, which he agreed. And that became a pathway to my earlier career, where I was working with not just traditional learners, but challenged learners and in physical activity. So motor skill development of all sorts. And then that expanded to other things. And I was in California for 10 years in that capacity, both at the elementary level and at the high school level as well. And then the nudge to get back to the East Coast took place. And I ended up with a couple of jobs in two different school districts, but ultimately in Greenwich, Connecticut, where I had received my master's out in San Diego. So now I was working, had applied for a position as an administrator. And this administrative position was a coordinator. They have a very unique and very all comprehensive program approach, where they have principals of the schools, but also coordinators who oversee various disciplines. And that way there's a checks and balances system set up so that no one discipline is shortchanged or over, indulged upon in order of in delivering the curriculum. So I oversaw health education, physical education, family and consumer sciences, social emotional learning, the entire athletics program. And we had a school district of 10,000 kids. We had, 15 schools. And then we had another school that was an alternative high school for those challenged kids who did not quite fit into the mold of the high school traditional education. These are kids that were considered at risk. They struggled with dysfunctional families and addictions and petty crime and those sorts of things. And so now they were in a school. We had about 60 students in that school. And one of the additional assignments that I received was to come up with a program that would engage these students in, not just in physical activity and whatnot, but also in learning, in reconnecting them to community. So working with the headmaster at that school and the teachers and social workers and whatnot, it was a small staff. We ended up implementing an adventure-based curriculum. So in an effort to reconnect the kids with community. So to build trust and responsibility and respect and all that within our school, but then to be able to extend it beyond the school. And the one thing that I really felt was necessary was outreach. I wanted the kids to be involved in giving back and also recognizing that they weren't dealt the worst hand of cards on the planet. That yes, they had challenges and whatnot, but they needed to look at what the rest of the, others dealt with in the life. And so I set up a program because of my background in elementary phys ed, where they became mentors for 3 and 4 year old preschool children who had special needs. And I taught my high school kids, these at-risk group, how to teach motor skills. And then we would go over once a week and work in this program. Now, this was not met with the greatest welcome from the community. They saw my kids as being the bad guys. These were the discarded stay clear of that group of kids. And yet we're working with the most vulnerable of special needs children at 3 and 4 years old. The community didn't like it, but the parents of the children, the little ones, loved it because they saw their kids coming home, learning how to stand on one foot, learning how to bounce a ball, work a hula hoop, throw things. It was amazing. And we called it Big Kids, Little Kids. And the little kids couldn't wait for the big kids to get over every week and partner up with them. And this was the day too, you got to remember where people had spiked their hair and it was that everyone was wearing black and they wore those bulldog necklaces and stuff. So our kids didn't look, particularly, welcoming, but the little guys didn't care. They had their big kid friend and they loved them. And it ultimately ended up changing where they actually put both populations in the same facility so that that program could continue on. But I say that to you, I explain that just because now, then I looked for a regional outreach and that was working with the homeless in soup kitchen and other service areas with that. And then I was wanting a global one. I thought we've got to get outside of our country. And a friend of mine was a flight attendant with American Airlines. Leanne Hansen was my best friend from high school. I hadn't seen much of her since high school, but I connected with her and we just got talking about our lives since we'd seen each other. And I was telling her that the passion I have for these kids, but I really would like to connect them globally. And she said, there's a woman, when we do flights down to Bogota, there's one of the gals that works for American Airlines down there, knows about an orphanage that's relatively young, probably 4 or 5 years old. And that might be a good connection for you. And so she connected me with the gal at American Airlines. And that woman connected me with an adoption coordinator who knew of the orphanage. And Leanne and I flew down and took our first trip up to Hogares Luz y Vida, the home of light and life. And knowing that I was going to take this trip, I had said to the high school kids, let's gather some stuff so I can bring some things, because it was early December. I said, we'll celebrate an early Christmas with them. We don't know what we're going to encounter, but let's just gather some stuff. And the kids went, all out trying to connect, to buy different things, get donations from people and whatnot. And all of the things that we were doing with this at-risk population was service-based learning. So they were learning the instructional objectives of their curricular areas through the modality of service. So this fit in really well. We brought all these things down there. Mike, when we set foot through the door of this orphanage, my life changed. I had never expected to see children who had such complex, complex physical and mental and emotional challenges, who were so happy, so joyful. The orphanage itself was fastidiously clean, and there was just a milieu of love, of joy there. And I couldn't get over it. I was like, they didn't see themselves through the lens of challenge. They saw themselves through the lens of capability. And so you would see, we had all these toys and stuff gathered. We put up a fake tree and what all that. And when we had our Christmas party celebration, the children who were deaf were guiding the children. And we're not talking like the teenage ones. I'm talking down at 4 and 5 years old. We're guiding those who were blind up to the tree and helping them pick out a gift. The children who were in wheelchairs, were wheeled. It was what you'd see a little train. You'd see a deaf child wheeling the wheelchair, and on her or his shoulders are the hands of a blind child. And this little train going up to the tree and gathering stuff and bringing it back to other children. It was mind-boggling. And I videotaped like crazy so I could bring the story of their reception back to my kids. Ultimately, to fast track that, the program went viral. We had such great participation from our kids on multiple levels, and then other schools in the district wanted to be involved. So probably 13 out of the 15 schools were involved in service-based learning projects of all natures in support of this little orphanage down in Columbia. The first visit that I took, there were about 40 children at the orphanage. Through the years, there more and more and more children have come for a multitude of reasons. Columbia tends to have a very affluent and a very poverty-stricken culture. There is not necessarily a big middle class, if you will. And so parents of special needs children who are in the poverty level, and I'm talking poverty, if you make $4 a day, that's a good day. But they can't afford to care for a child who's got special needs. And a lot of the affluent would bring them to hospitals and other places and leave them figuring that they'd get better care, you know, with somebody else.
I almost don't know where to go. I want to get to the crazy nun. I want to get to a number of things.
Yes.
But you said, and thank you for sharing that detail, Queen. That's very helpful. And I need to let you know, and listeners, that I get to watch my guests. I don't use YouTube. I only use audio podcast capabilities. There were times I swear I was watching my sister as I was listening to you. I have a sister that is on the board of trustees. I call it a glorified school board, and she would slap me silly for saying that. The board of trustees for the Washoe County School District, which is Reno, Nevada. And I have listened to my sister for years talk about, and she's been involved with kids forever. And I swear there were times I was watching my sister Diane as I was listening to you, Colleen. You know, here's my first question.
Mm-hmm.
So you leave Vermont and you go to California and there's no program. And so you develop one.
Right.
Where did this trailblazer Colleen thing come from? Where in your back? Because you're a trailblazer, Colleen. You're an agent of change. Where did that come? And you were so young. I need to understand that a little bit better.
Wow. Well, I thank you for such a glorious title to be placed on me. I don't necessarily see myself in that capacity, but I will say I grew up in a home of two of the most amazing parents with an older sister and a younger sister that I could ever dream of having. And I don't say that lightly. I don't say that flippantly because I watched with my parents things that they dealt with through the years. They were devoted to their faith in God. And, but their devotion and how they applied it in our lives, in the lives of our family, really spoke to me in a real deep way. And I will share one segment that maybe will help define this trailblazer image. When my dad was 38 and my mom was 34, my dad had gone for just his regular old physical. Now, when he was in World War II, he was stationed in Guam and picked up a parasite and had to have one kidney removed at that time. But, you know, he was fine. And he and my mom married. So he was 38. She was 34. I think I was 8 years old, my older sister 10 and my younger sister 5. And he had this physical. And a week later, the doctor called and said, I'd like you to come back in and your wife should come with you, too. I want to talk about your test results. And at that meeting, the doctor said, this is not great news. You have cancer in your testicle. You've got some problems with your colon, and only one third of your remaining kidney is functioning. And my mom had been a graduate of Mayo Clinic, a very bright woman. She was full scholarship, but from Mayo Clinic to study medicine. And She said to the doctor, "So what are we talking here?" And he said, "Well, we can remove the testicle. We can do a little surgery with the colon, but there's nothing we can do with the kidney." And this is in the 60s. They didn't have dialysis or transplants. So she said, "So what is the bottom line?" And he said, "2 weeks, 2 months, maybe 2 years to live, I'd get my affairs in order." And so with that, my mom decided to really delve into what would keep that kidney functioning. They did do the surgery, and he was radiated for his testicular cancer. But the kidney thing remained. And I remember the most vivid memories of that season for me were prayer, praying for daddy. "Please, dear Jesus, heal my daddy." Simple childlike prayers. I have Father's Day cards that we gave to dad. "Dear daddy, you need to rest, 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 and Jesus will heal you," you know, those kinds of things. But witnessing the solid commitment to God's will and to their faith was life altering for me. And it wasn't necessarily at the time. It was years later when I looked back at that and how prayer was just such an essential element of life. My mom changed all of what he was eating and that a lot of what we were eating and made it very natural. No one was doing nutritional approaches back then. No one was doing physical fitness activities. And so she incorporated both of those things into his life and into us as a family. We thought all families went out for vigorous walks and swimming and weight training and all this stuff. And it was like, no, we were the ones, you know. But my dad lived to be 76 years old. And which was, you know, nearly 30 years, 40 years, I'm sorry, longer than what the doctor had said. And he had a full, abundant life. He played golf, he swam, he did all kinds of things with us. But that kind of thing, seeing like, let's try nutrition, let's try fitness, let's try this. And it worked. And I think it was an inherent thing in my parents' parenting that we go and try things. If this doesn't work, we try something else. And here I was 3,000 miles away out in California, and I knew I needed to do something. I didn't want to drive back across the country and try to figure things out. And it was too late to start the semester with, you know, going to classes and student teaching in the spring. So it seemed a natural next step. Just, hey, let's try it.
That
So,
helps me a lot. Thank you for sharing that. And wish I could have met your mom and your
oh my
dad.
goodness, yeah.
So back to Bogota, when your friend gets you connected in Bogota at the orphanage, did the Light and Life Foundation exist at that time?
No.
Okay.
The orphanage name, Hogares Luz e Vida, means the home of light and life. And what happened was that there was a group of us that were very eagerly involved, and we took trips I was taking 3 or 4 trips a year during my school vacations. And people were saying, "I want to come with you." So teachers came, friends came, family came. It became, I mean, it's at one point in time, we had 29 people on one of these visits down to the orphanage, and we would collect stuff and bring it down there. It did start get challenging with customs down there, who would kind of question, "What are we bringing all this stuff in?" Because they don't want you to take away from their businesses. So some things were collected, and we never got them out of customs. So we started doing a lot more fundraising to try to provide things and then purchase them down in Colombia. And another crazy story. I was watching Dateline one night and heard a story about Betty Tisdale. Betty had airlifted children out of Vietnam at the end of the Vietnam War. And she did this as she was inspired by Dr. Tom Dooley, who had set up jungle clinics and orphanages even before the Vietnam War started. He was an army surgeon, and she became a cor helping him with his correspondence just for like a few months before he passed away. He died at 34 years old, but she had met him, and she knew she couldn't go and just leave his work unattended to. You know, she had read the books that he wrote and had met him and was doing correspondences for him. And when he died, she was like, "What am I going to do? I can't just let the orphanages go without being cared for." So she ended up quit. She went and took a trip over to the orphanages in Vietnam and came back and told her best friend. She was working as a secretary for U.S. Steel in Pittsburgh, and she said, "You know, I'm going to quit. I've got to go and help these orphanages." And her friend said, "And what are you going to do? Hold babies all day? You need to do the kind of work that Dr. Dooley did and collect things and provide for them through what you're able to offer from here to there." And so she still quit her job. She went to New York City, ended up getting a secretarial job with Senator Jacob Javits, and that gave her access to a lot of very influential people, the president of Johnson and Johnson and Heinz and those kinds of businesses. And so she would get donations of diapers and all kinds of stuff. Dateline ended up doing a story on her in 2020, in the year 2000. And I happened to be watching that. Betty had was 78 years old at that time. She had, well, her story is insane anyway, but she had had started a foundation called HALO, HALO, for helping and loving orphans. Since the time of helping Dr. Dooley, she had met another army surgeon and married him. He was widowed with five boys, and she said to him, "I'm not going to hem little trousers all my life. Let's adopt some girls." And they adopted five of the most needy children from the orphanages in Vietnam. So at 50 years old, she started with 10 children. And during the next how many years, 28 years, you know, she raised her kids, and then she wanted to resurrect her helping the orphanages over in Vietnam. So she started this foundation. And I'm watching this story. They re there was a Dateline had or I'm sorry, it was Life magazine, which is owned by NBC. Life magazine did a feature that said, if just a little paragraph, if you could meet anyone on the planet, or I think maybe in the United States that you wanted, who would you meet? And one gal responded, "I would want to meet Betty Tisdale because I know that she airlifted me out of Vietnam when I was just an infant. And so I see her as a mother in some capacity of mine. I know I have an adopted mother and a biological mother, but I'd like to meet Betty." So they arranged for this gal, Vicky, to fly out to Seattle and meet Betty. And it was that segment that was aired on Dateline that I'm watching this and I'm in tears as they reunited. And Betty is talking about this foundation that she started and all the things that she was able to do during the years of helping these orphanages in Vietnam. So I emailed her. I thought, I don't know how big her foundation is or whatnot, but I'll email and see what happens. And I just said who I am and what I'm involved with in Bogota, and I'd love to learn from her. And she emailed back the next day, "I will tell you everything I know about helping orphanages if you let me come with you on one of your trips." And so for the next, well, until she was 90, she actually celebrated her 90th birthday with us down at the orphanage. But she came on all the trips with us, taught me abundantly all about how to do fundraising and collections and this and that, the other thing. And so I credit her. And she had a foundation, so we would do our fundraising under the umbrella of HALO. And then I want to say she was like 88 years old, and she said, "Colleen, I'm not going to live forever. You need to start your own foundation, and I'll teach you how to do it. You've seen what I do, but I'll help you." And so it was in 2009 that we started the Light and Life Foundation and broke off from HALO and became our own entity. And we named ourselves the Light and Life Foundation after the orphanage. So,
In fact, folks, it's lightandlifefoundation.org.
yes.
You need to go there for a number of reasons. I'm going to use that to tee up the crazy nun. As a kid that grew up in the Catholic school system, kindergarten through high school, I know some crazy nuns, by the way. But this Sister Martine is really quite a remarkable person.
Yes.
Tell me about your first meeting with her.
It was that day when we walked through the orphanage door to have that first Christmas. Yes, her name is actually Sister Valeriana Isabel Garcia Martin.
I'm glad you said that. That's why I went to Martine, because I wouldn't remember the rest of it. Thank you.
So we just call her Sister Valeriana. She's just a little itty bitty thing. She's all of like maybe pushing 4 foot 8. She's just tiny and mighty. And I'll tell you, Mike, what struck me, it wasn't just Sister Valeriana, it was all of the caregivers that were working with the children at that time. There was a milieu in there that was palpable of love and affection and compassion. Everybody that came to work, the caregivers that were coming in, and there weren't a lot at that time. She really didn't have a lot of help, but they meet and greet each other with a hug and a kiss every single day coming in. And all I could think of was, oh my gosh, if that was the way we treated each other when we'd walk into the workplace, what a different way this world would be. But yeah, she was very cheerful, quick to laugh, and just very relaxed in herself. The translator that was with us was this woman who was the adoption coordinator, Helena. She's still a very good friend. And she would translate the conversations for us. And Valeriana explained her story, which was she was born in Spain, and she was one of 14 children. She really deeply in her soul felt a call from God. She was came from a very faith-based family that ran a farm. And so she ultimately went to, I don't know the process that people go through to become a nun, but she became a nun. And I she became affiliated with one of the, with an order. As I said, I'm not 100% sure of how that whole process works, but that order sent her to do projects in an Institute for the Blind in Bogota, Colombia. So that's where she went. And she worked at the Institute for quite a few years. She was frustrated, though, in seeing that some of the kids, there was a disparity in how the kids were being cared for. Some were given more attention than others. As you know, it's an Institute for the Blind, and there was even like a little infant who, I mean, want to say she was a year old or something, who was really considered too small to be adopted. She was blind, who's going to adopt her? And the Institute kind of, put her on the sidelines. And Valeriana was very upset about that. And she was upset about the number of kids that were brought to the Institute and left there, not to be retrieved by parents. And so she proposed to her order that she start a daycare program, which they said was fine, and she did. And then she decided these children needed, they were ending up on the streets, so they needed a home. And her order said, well, you're going to really have to make a decision here because you can't do both, working for, the Institute and starting a home. So she ended up leaving her order. She still honors her vows to God, and she ended up, she adopted that little toddler, that little infant. She was a year and a half when she adopted her legally, and then took a trip back to Spain to visit her family and told her family what she was wanting to do, was starting a home. And they collected some money just among her siblings. They didn't have a lot, but enough to buy a used car. And she said, well, I don't need a used car. I need a home. But she took the money, came back to Bogota, and went up to the neighborhood of San Cristobal, which is in the foothills of the Andes Mountains. Very poor location. A lot of poverty up that way. But she found a dirt floor garage and purchased that with the money for this used car and started her home with four blind children. She didn't have any furniture. She went, and this is the crazy nun, and this is how her reputation, you know, she went out looking for, you know, she needed beds. So she collected discarded truck and car tires and got discarded burlap sacks and wrapped the burlap over the top of the car tires to use for beds for the children. And she bartered with some of the neighbors in, you know, and there, it's a big neighborhood. I mean, there's, you know, hundreds of families there who might have some talent in plumbing or electric or that kind of thing. And she would care for their children while, you know, they went to work. And then when they came home from work, they would do some work on the this dirt floor garage. And oh, goodness, I guess it was she shared with me on that first trip down there that she had what she calls her angry prayer to God. And in the first little room that she had built at the orphanage or, you know, created was a little chapel. And she went into this little chapel and knelt down and said, you know, I am so grateful for the opportunity that you've given me to care for these children. I love this home, but I can't figure out how to provide food for them. And I'm giving this back to you. You'll have to figure out I'm getting food. Because at that time, the, you know, she was getting bits and pieces from the neighbors, but the neighbors were poor as well. And within a week, a farmer arrived on his way back from the market, and he had vegetables and fruits that he had not sold at the market. And he said, I have heard that you need some help with food. Would you be able to use these products? And she said, yes. And then he went off and told his fellow market partners, buddies, you know, that they would, yes, there's a place for anything we don't sell. We can bring it there. She has never been in need of food for the children since then. And it's not, doesn't continue with being those market persons. Our foundation has contributed to buying and creating a farm out in the farms are in Colombia are up in the mountains. They're not flat farmland like we have in the States. But yeah, so there's a farm that our physically able children, well, they're grown. They're in their late teens, 20s and 30s now, live and work the farm. And 85% of the food that is needed at the residence is created out and is produced out at the farm. And then we have chickens and turkeys and pigs. I mean, the big pigs, the ones the size of our bathtubs, you know, and goats and, oh my goodness, everything. We've got a couple of gals that came on our trip, bought horses for equestrian therapy. We have a fish hatchery that the kids go into the pond. We lower the water level and they catch the fish with their hands and you know, whatever, fillet them, you know, and freeze them so that that is shipped back to the orphanage. It's an unbelievable, unbelievable process. But I think that farm is her brainchild because she was looking for these kids weren't fitting into the kind of educational provisions that were available. Now, in Colombia, you have to pay to go to public school. So the kids couldn't, we didn't have the money to it. I say we because it's my family too now, you know, they didn't have the money to attend. And so at one point in time, she ended up starting a school in just like an abandoned house And she invited the neighborhood kids, and it was a reverse inclusion school. So it was designed for special needs, and then those with traditional learning were invited to join too. So what has happened since that is that the government had a property that no one wanted, couldn't be sold. They ended up giving it to her, and she completed a grant that provided for funding to build a school. It's an elementary school going from pre-K up to seventh grade. And the neighborhood children who can't afford going to the public school come to our school. And so there's about 200 children in the school right now. And so it
Before I
just,
get to my next question,
yeah.
so as I was just listening to you talk about Sister Valerina Martin, I'm sitting here thinking, one person I always wanted to meet was Mother Teresa.
Yeah.
And I think they're mirrors of one another.
Yes.
As I spent some time on the website, again, lightandlifefoundation.org, I don't know if these were her words. I'm just not sure. The two quotes just struck me. Bring the able-bodied and disabled together, and those who can are expected to help those who can't. And I had to write those down because it's simple
Right.
and important and
Right.
so true.
Right.
I'm going to go back to part of your story, and maybe you said it and I missed it. So here's Colleen the educator. You're moved to do more. And a friend is a flight attendant. That's what we used to call them with American
Right.
Airlines. And you get connected with the people at the orphanage.
Right.
Where did you walk away? Because I'm assuming you walked away from your educational career, and because I think you're all in here. Help me understand that process.
Okay. Well, actually, because this project took on a life of its own within the Greenwich community, we year after year continued to help the children in the orphanage. And as I said earlier, it was through service-based learning. So we would do things like, oh, elementary school kids would collect school supplies for the school. Children who were in, and this was elementary school up through the high school, who were in Spanish learning, Spanish instructional classes, we would make videos. And it was part of the children learning how to speak Spanish at the elementary level and at the high school level. But we would videotape them saying, "Hello, my name is, Colleen. I'm 8 years old. I have a mom and a dad and two brothers and sisters and a dog, and I live, blah, blah, blah," that kind of thing. Just introducing themselves, just a little snippet, but they were doing it in the Spanish language. And then we would compile all these videos and bring them down and share them with the kids down there. And then we would videotape them introducing themselves and bring it back to Greenwich. So it was both, especially the population we were focusing on for the service-based learning was our kids in Greenwich. And they would learn more Spanish through the modality of service. We had kids that were struggling with communication skills, and this would be at more of the high school level, middle and high school level. And we'd arrange for those kids to go and do presentations in our elementary schools about what the orphanage is about and what their needs are, so that they'd be comfortable with a population that was very receptive instead of feeling challenged in communication skills with their own peer group or older. You see, so every aspect of this, oh my, I mean, it extended through so many different disciplines. It was language, it was the kids in the physical activity classes, physical education would get pledges for the number of laps they would do around the track when we do this project called Run for Life, and we'd raise money. So they would get, we had days that we'd bring the moms and dads and pushing a stroller, and everyone that went a lap around would get contribute towards that pledge. So we did a lot of different initiatives, all under the umbrella of the service-based learning. And it was very powerful. And we'd have, I would fly Sister Valeriana up. We did assemblies in the schools. I flew Betty Tisdale out from Seattle, and she would, the two of them together would tell their stories. And it ignited the kids. One story that lasted for over 5 years was one little boy in a kindergarten class when they had finished hearing Sister Valeriana and Betty Tisdale talk about these children in these other countries that didn't have, you know, a lot of the luxuries and toys and those sort of things that kids have. The kindergarten teacher was debriefing with them back in the classroom. And she said, "So does anybody have any thoughts of what you think? What did you hear today? And what do you want to talk about?" And this little boy raised his hand. His name was Zach. And he said, "I think every child should have their own bed. Why don't all the children have their own beds?" And the teacher said, "Well, they don't have the money to buy them." And he said, "Well, why can't we buy beds for them?" And, you know, she was processing this with the class. And she said, "So what do we need to do that?" And they were like, "Money. So how are we going to get money?" And these kindergartners, we're talking five-year-old children, organized selling lemonade in the summer, hot chocolate in the winter, and in Connecticut collecting, you know, cans and bottles, you get a 5 cent refund. And they did that. At the end of their school year, they had raised $950. The beds were $50 each. And we went down and we bought 19 beds. And then when that young man, Zach, went to the next grade level, he continued with this initiative. So ultimately, every bed in the orphanage was fundraised and provided by this little boy's initiatives. And this is, gosh, this is way back. He ultimately went to a private school when he became a sixth grader because he needed more help with his own learning capabilities. He was a little bit challenged with dyslexia, I believe it was. And the teacher at that school said to him, "You know, we're excited to have you here." And he said, "Well, I'm just worried that I won't be able to do the things with the orphanage anymore." And she said, "Well, what's this orphanage?" And he told her what he knew. And he remembered my name. And she looked me up and called me and said that she's got these kids in her class and they want to be involved with this orphanage. And Zach is kind of the spearhead one. So they ended up in their resource room activities, learning how to quilt. And they quilted enough blankets for every kid in the orphanage to have on their bed. And they called the project Every Stitch with Love. So Jeepers. That's the kind of thing that happened. And Mike, what happened through the years, I stayed in my career until I had my 35 years in education. Because I had started at 21 years old, I was finished at 56 years old. And, you know, so I retired. And all through the time I was, you know, we had the foundation running and I was able to balance both things, doing the, you know, foundation work on my weekends and evenings and the school stuff during the work day. And it's kind of how it played out. I've never given up on the, you never put one thing aside for the other until I retired. So.
Well, before I get to my next question, I wrote this note, The Innocence of Children. And I'll use me as an example. I don't know what happens as we grow and mature, we get busy. And again, I'm talking about me. And I'm sure there's at least one other person like me. And sometimes I get so busy in this activity of life and sometimes focus on things that I really can't change or impact anyway. And then I bark about it or grumble about it and get worked up about things. And along the way, I've lost some of that innocence and heart when I was a little kid, like Zach. And it's really important, I think, for people like me to regain that. So how can we help the foundation, Colleen? What do you need? I mean, let's just talk, prayers and missionaries and money. Let's talk about how we can help with these wonderful, precious children down in Bogota.
Well, we have quite a few projects on our plate. The significant one right now is we are constructing a 42-bed chronic care medical unit, two doors down from the orphanage. Over the past, well, I've been involved with the orphanage now for 27 years. And over that span of time, we have constructed a Champions Club, which is a multi-sensory autism center. It's based on Craig Johnson, who is a pastor in Texas, on his model for reaching autistic children. He had a son, has a son who's autistic, and he researched what is needed. And so we ended up implementing and constructing. It's actually a room that has multi-sensory stimulation. So we've built that, and we have a total in all of the homes of Luzie Vida together, we have 235 kids. And as I said, we've constructed the school, we've bought the farm, we also have a sewing center that is phenomenal, and that came out of the consumer science aspect of my career, where the teachers got involved and the students got involved. All of the bedspreads now, sheets, underwear, school uniforms, staff uniforms, and all of the bolster pads for kids in wheelchairs, all of that are made in our sewing center. And the older kids who are now past the school years, this is their baby. They have kids with contracted hands, and you see them in there cutting out fabric, and you're humbled at it's very humbling, because you kind of go, what am I complaining about? Why am I thinking that my life has any difficulties, when you're seeing how joyful and how engaged and how fulfilling the lives are of these children who have such complex challenges? Our foundation is does we designed developed it so that we could help with making their lives more abundant, more beneficial, and come alongside. We've purchased a refrigerator truck to transport the food from the farm to the main residence, generators to make sure electricity stays on when power goes out, because we have also constructed a respiratory care center and a physical therapy center within the confines of the orphanage. And this chronic care unit seemed like the next reasonable step, because so often we can't get kids to the hospital in time. They don't get the care they need. And this would be staffed by Natalia Cuervo, who is our orphanage doctor. Her mother and father were working at the Institute from the Blind with Sister Valeriana, and they ended up coming and being the directors of the orphanage for the past 33 years. All right, so Natalia, being the doctor that we currently have at the orphanage, she's 34 years old. She had done an additional class, taken additional class at university, that their project that they assigned for her thesis was all the students needed to design some kind of medical facility, that was, a large scale kind of thing. And so she designed a 30-bed chronic care medical unit. This project required details from construction, basic construction, all the way through to staffing and equipping it. And she got glowing grades on it. She came home after receiving those grades and shared it with her family. And Sister Valeriana, being Sister Valeriana, said, "Well, why don't we build one?" So she put together a team. It's a crowdfunding approach, and each of our foundations and organizations have been given an assignment. That was the initial part. Some of these groups have pulled out, but at this moment, we have completed the external structure and windows and all that, all the piping for gases and all that's already completed. And we're at the electrical phase inside, just putting the final bits and pieces of that together. And then they'll put on the walls and the floors, and we'll need to furnish it. And so we have a, you know, it's a huge undertaking financially, but it will basically save lives. We won't be losing lives trying to get through Colombia's very dense traffic, trying to get kids to the hospital. We'll have our own right there, but it'll also serve people that can't afford going to another facility to be able to access ours. So that's our big project. And we've got, you know, I just returned from Colombia. I was there for 8 days with a small group of people and toured the facility again to see where we are. And that's our need, is to get that structure and that program going. The thing that it's important for you to know is there are a couple things about, like, Natalia grew up alongside the orphans. She was like 2 years old when her parents started working there. So this is family to her. She's an extremely bright young lady, and has she working with the contractor is overseeing all the details of what needs to be included in this. And you know, just a fascinating gal. There is also, though, and I mentioned that Sister Valeriana had adopted the blind child at a year and a half old. I don't want to forget to mention this story because this ties into this whole medical thing. And that is that the orphanage was probably about 5 months old when, knock, knock on the door at midnight, a police officer was there. And he had a baby in his arms. And what had happened is this baby had been found by a bus driver, wrapped in a black sack under the seat of his bus. She had cerebral palsy, had a variety of viruses, was drug and alcohol addicted, had cigarette burns all over her body. She'd been quite severely abused. And the bus driver brought her to the hospital, and the hospital assessed her and said, "There's nothing we can do. She's going to die. So bring her to the police. We can't help her. There's no parents or whatever." So the bus driver brought her to the police department, and there was somebody in the police department that had heard about the orphanage, and they ended up bringing, now it was only 5 months old at this time, so there was just a handful of blind children there at that moment. The police department brought the baby up to Luz y Vida and told Sister Valeriana the story I've just shared with you. And Valeriana said, "Well, I don't know that doctors decide when we live and die. I think when God wants to bring us home, he'll bring us home. So we will take her and give her a name, and she will be in our family as any other child that's in this home. And when God decides to bring her home, then we'll accept that." So she named her Rosita, and she actually ended up adopting her as well as her own child. Well, I say to you this moment, Rosita is now 33 years old. She cannot use her arms or her legs from the cerebral palsy. She had quite severe. She does not have speech. But when she was a child, she and Sister Valeriana developed a language using their eyes. And, you know, loosely, of course, it didn't have a lot of details, but they could communicate. And Rosita became the inspiration for the school as well, because she kept, when she'd be sitting outside in her wheelchair and she'd see kids going to school, and she, you know, didn't ask Valeriana, "Where are they going?" And she said, they go to a place called school, and what that was. And she said, "Well, why don't I get to go to school? Why don't the other children here go to school. So that was the inspiration for starting the school. But Rosita, when she turned, I want to say she was 19 or 20 years old, one of the people on our board of directors was connected with a business in, I think it's Sweden, that had developed an eye tracking technology device called a Tobii, Tobii. And they ultimately donated a Tobii for us to bring down to the orphanage. They're $25,000 devices. They're very complex in their eye tracking technology. And they also provided a trainer to come and calibrate Rosita's eyes with the Tobii and teach her how to use it. So on the Tobii device, it's just like an iPad, but there are canned conversations like food and, activities and those sort of, and then there's also very detailed personal things that get developed over time. Plus, there's also a keyboard on the screen, like an iPad might have, and she could look and type out, looking at any letter for 2 seconds or longer once her eyes were calibrated to it, and then look at the type out things, and then look at the picture of a mouth, and that would speak what she had just typed. So Rosita was able to. She was going to school with our other kids, but now she was able to more visually be engaged in the, actual production of her learning rather than just receiving and that sort of thing. Rosita, as I said, is now 33 years old, and she is in her second year of medical school. Yeah, there you go. Mike, I received a series of WhatsApp texts. That's how Sister Valeriana and I communicate when I'm not there. There were little videos. There probably were 8 or 10 of them. And I don't speak fluent Spanish. I get by, but and so I passed them on to a friend of mine who's actually on our board of directors, Catalina. And Catalina is an attorney who grew up in Colombia. And so I passed them on to her and I said, "What is this? I don't know what she's sending me." And she texted back after listening to it, "Oh, this is a presentation that Rosita has developed on macro and micronutrients." And I just sat there in awe and thinking, how of Valeriana's words when she received that baby into her home, and Rosita is joyful. Oh my gosh. I mean, we. You can't believe what you are seeing when you go into this home. This is a home of light and life. And we pride ourselves in naming our foundation Light and Life because it gives hope, it gives purpose, it gives love, it gives family, it gives needs being met and things beyond our comprehension. It brings the light of the Lord into these children's lives and the life that they deserve. In terms of all of their rights and medical needs and educational needs and family needs. And, Sister Valeriana, if there's any one theme that she says that repeats, is that let all we do be done with love. And I think that comes from Corinthians, something to that degree. Let all we do with love, whether we're changing a diaper, mopping a floor. Feeding a child, it doesn't matter. We do it with love. We're here to care for one another. That's why God put us on this planet. We're here to love. We're here to care for each other. And where we have capabilities and some may have disabilities, we are called to come alongside. And they will teach us how to love them because of what we're able to do. And that's what you see. That's what you experience. As I said, it's not just visual, it's not just auditory. It penetrates into your soul. A friend of mine that I also knew, Leanne, that went to high school with me, she came down with me last week on this first time trip of hers. And she's just in awe of the whole thing. It's like we come back and try to re-enter into a culture that's so different from what we've just experienced and been saturated in. And we don't quite know what to do. It's like, how do we share our story so that people understand what this is and the beauty of what it is, coupled with the need of what they have and what they don't have, you know? And that to me is, that's what we celebrate, you know? And as I said, that's why we're here. That it's truly the, you know, we're here to be caregivers for one another. And what I've learned at Luzy Vida over the past 27 years, and what I learned in my family growing up with my mom and dad and sisters, I was able to really apply during the last 2 years of my mom's life. She passed away 8 years ago, but she developed a very abrupt dementia following surgery to repair a broken leg. She needed to have a rod put in. And the woman that was wheeled out of surgery was not the woman that was wheeled in. And she could no longer live alone. Cognitively, she was not my mom. You know, she still knew me. She still could do some things, but she was now in a wheelchair. She ultimately graduated to a walker, but she could not live alone in terms of any aspect of personal care or whatever. So I ended up moving her with me. We spent summers in Florida and winters in Florida. I get my seasons mixed up being here, and summers in Connecticut. And how many times during those 2 years did I learn, you know, learn more about being in today and being joyful for what today presents, to be present with who we're with today. And I would see that at the orphanage, but I was able to apply it firsthand in my own life, to be thankful for today and to find the goodness that today has to offer, not to be regretting what yesterday's presented to us, and not to be anxious about what tomorrow's might be, but to be present with who we are with and why we are with them for today. And that's what our foundation strives to bring to the lives of the children, is to be into today's needs for them. They'll have abundant needs coming down the road. We can't anticipate what governments will do and all that, you know, sort of thing, but we can be with them today and get their needs, you know, strive to get their needs met today while we learn to love better. And they have taught us how to love. There's amorous love, you know, there's family love, there's friendship love, but this is a love that God teaches. And it's a love of surrendering and accepting and then celebrating the privilege of being able to do those two things. We surrender who we are and we accept what we have in front of us. And then we dive in and embrace it.
Colleen, thank you so much for taking time to join me. Thank you so much for what you're doing. Folks, it's lightandlifefoundation.org. Please visit the site and get involved in any way that's, you know, appropriate for you. You know, I want to ask the good Lord to continue to bless you and the Crazy Nun, the staff, all the people that you work with, the children that you're called to serve, and then those people that follow you that have an interest in helping and supporting. I want to lift all of you up and put you in His hands, and His grace will provide.
Amen.
Thank you so much for what you're doing. It's been such a pleasure meeting you. And I'll have to thank Nathan and his entrepreneur friend that made all this possible, and then ultimately the Crazy Nun and the good Lord. So,
yeah,
Colleen, thank you so much for taking time to join me. You've just inspired me beyond belief.
Well, thank the Lord.